Robert Parrish on celebrating his trade to Boston, the Big Three, and getting into a skirmish with Michael Jordan. It's the Wednesday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Raining Jay's back with the vengeance at all the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline, global but it got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line, play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play, when the F's done I can't wait until the next day, trying to stay in tune with the C's, that's the best way. Melis. John Corrales here of MassLive.com, welcoming you back to this historical deep dive. We're in the 1980s, and if you've missed the first two episodes of this week, you missed my conversation with Danny Ainge, who was very kind in spending an hour with me talking about his time in Boston, how things looked from his perspective in Boston over the 8 years that he was in town. This episode is going to be an interview with Robert Parrish, but this interview was actually done a few years ago, and I thought this would be perfect to kind of re-release right now. This was done before this podcast was even the Locked On Celtics podcast. It was done when it was the Rain and Jay's podcast, so it's me and Jay King. So Jay King is on this podcast asking questions of Robert Parrish, but it was done so long ago, not that long ago, but it was done long enough ago where we didn't have the listenership that we have now. I mean, frankly, the show has grown thanks to your ratings and reviews and sharing the podcast, that it's grown to be quite popular. And I thought, look, we've got a lot of new listeners. We've got a lot of people, even though I've tweeted out the link to this piece, it hasn't gone out into people's feeds again. And I thought this would be a perfect opportunity during this hiatus, talking about the 80s, to talk about a guy who was there, part of the Big Three. And so this conversation was really great with Robert Parrish. We get into his arrival in Boston, how he celebrated that trade from Golden State. We talk all about the Big Three, and then his departure. And there's even a Michael Jordan story in there about how he was challenged and he kind of like stood up to Michael Jordan. So in this era of The Last Dance and everybody focused on Jordan again, that's a good story to hear. So here's the conversation. Again, a conversation that was done a few years ago. So Jay King is on this podcast. So it's me and Jay King and our conversation with Robert Parrish. Chief, thank you for joining us today. You were known as a pretty good jump shooter as a center. If you played today, you think that you could fit into the style and maybe extend your range? Could you get out to the corner and hit a three in today's game?
No, sir. I am not a three-point shooter. My range is out to 18 feet. And that's about as far as I can shoot it accurately. But because of the freedom and space that is created by the perimeter game today, I think I would fit in effectively because I can go outside. So I would be an inside-outside player.
So you would hit the post first, would you? What do you think What do you think about these guys that, that you're being asked to shoot from three? What would you tell a coach today if he said, "Hey, let's get you out into the corner. Let's see what you can do."
Well, the coach got to respect me because I know my limitations. And so I know that's not me. One player that mirrors my game, I think, is Paul Gasol, that plays for the Chicago Bulls. He has the ability to go out to 18 feet, and he plays inside, outside. So his game mirrors my game, in my opinion. Even though he has better range, I think he's capable of shooting three-pointers.
That's an interesting comparison. I never linked those two together, but that is a good comparison. Now you played more than 20 seasons in the NBA. How did you stay healthy and motivated for that long?
Well, obviously I have had a love affair for the game, and I never sustained a major injury. That played a part. Genetics played a part. And to hop on that old cliche, I kept my himself in great physical condition year round, which most pro athletes do anyways.
Now, was there any trick? Did you do yoga, anything like that? Was there a trick to it?
Stretching definitely played a part. I took some yoga classes, and I also took some martial arts. I studied martial arts for 10, 12 years and big emphasis on stretching. And also the yoga, obviously, focuses on stretching. So I did a lot of stretching, and I think that enabled me to keep my flexibility and keep me agile. Because as you age, you get stiffer, a little tighter, and you're not as mobile. So I think that the stretching played a major part, a reason why I was able to play as long as I played.
What kind of martial arts did you do?
Kung Fu.
Kung Fu? Now, did you become a black belt? How far did you reach?
They don't give belts, you know, okay. In Kung Fu. So, but I'll just say this. I can take care of myself. I'll leave it at that.
We will not test that at all. But I'm sure Bill Lambier can attest to that.
Maybe.
Another guy who can attest to that, Michael Jordan. You kind of got into it with him at practice. What happened there?
Well, Michael has a tendency to test his teammates, especially the new faces on the team. And I think it was more of a test than a threat. He was just testing, you know, my reaction to his being a bully. And so I didn't back down. You know, he said he would kick my butt. And I told him, if you feel that strongly about it, come and get some. That was the end of it. You know, we didn't have another confrontation, if you will. It was just a test. I like I said, I don't think, at least I didn't read anything into it. I think it was just a test to see how I respond.
How close were you to actually fighting Michael Jordan?
He was at half court, and I was at the top of the key. and also, I think it was a little ticked off, too, because the second team was kicking their butt at the time, and I was talking trash, too.
See, a lot of people don't think of you as a trash talker. Larry was the trash talker, right?
Yes.
But you go ahead.
But only reason why I was talking trash to Michael was because he and Scotty was enjoying their dominance over the second team. And then when the second team finally got a center that could enhance their abilities, the first team no longer could enjoy dominance over the second team. So I just want to let them know that they're no longer the king on the block.
That's amazing. Let's go back a little bit to the trade, because right now this new generation of Celtics fans, they're enjoying this the progression of a trade that could be one of the best trades in franchise history, but you happen to be part of the best trade that essentially brought you and Kevin McHale to Boston that created the Big Three. So think back to that day when you first got the call in Golden State, you're going to Boston. What were the thoughts that were going through your head at that time?
I was surprised initially, but once I hung up from the Warriors after they called me and told me that I was being traded to the Boston Celtics, I cheered and I jumped up and down and I treated myself to a stiff drink. Because I went from purgatory to the penthouse, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That... I think that worked out well.
Oh, yeah, very well. For me, anyway. I can't speak for the Warriors. But for me and my career, being traded to the Celtics changed the trajectory of my career.
That's so funny, because our next question was, how much did you think that changed your personal career trajectory? Obviously, it helped you play for some incredible teams. But personally, how much did it change?
Oh, it gave me incentive, and I was motivated to play the game again, because I was seriously thinking about having a very short basketball career before the trade because of all the losing that I experienced with the Warriors and being blamed for the Warriors' demise. I understand it because I was the number one player taken, and the blame falls on my shoulder. But basketball is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. And I just feel like the team was an assemble of misfits and too much independent thinking. Guys were thinking about themselves as opposed to the team. And that was so rewarding about being with the Celtics because they was all about team. You know, you play for the name on the front of the jersey, not the name on the back of the jersey. So it was refreshing for me because that's my mentality.
So the man who played more than anybody in the NBA may have actually played a very short career had you stayed in Golden State.
Oh, no question about it. With the players I was playing with, I could not get them to understand the benefits and the rewards of playing together. They didn't get it for whatever reason.
And then you go to the Celtics, and they do get it. One of the teams that you played for, that was probably I would assume that you would agree it's the best team you played for, the 85-86 Celtics.
Ooh.
Did you guys have as much fun as it seemed? What was it like playing for that particular team?
It was a beautiful time in my professional career. Playing with like-minded people. We all on the same page, competing for one goal, and that's to achieve excellence. In regards to the NBA championship, and I have so much respect for that team because everybody on that team put their egos aside for the team, and that's rare. You're talking about some major egos in that locker room, and we sacrifice our egos to try to achieve a common goal, and that's why I have so much respect for those players.
Was that a collective thing? Like, how do you, because that is the same thing that is said of the new Big Three era with Garnett and Pierce and Ray Allen, that egos were sacrificed to achieve that common goal. Was there a particular player in that locker room that kind of led that charge? Did somebody have to be put in line? How does something like that happen? Or does everybody just realize it at the same time? We have to play a certain way.
Starts at the top. Red preaches selflessness. Starts with him. And then the coach preached the same rhetoric. And then the players got to buy into that philosophy because it won't work if the players don't buy into it. And we all want to be winners. We all want to be champions. And that played a part also. So the Red and the coaches really didn't have to do much of a selling job in terms of making sacrifices because it's something that the players wanted anyways. And we all believe you can never have enough championships, ever. And I think it's one of the reasons why Larry Kim and myself are Hall of Famers. I don't think it's so much about our individual talents. I think it says a lot about the great teams that we were a part of. I think that's one of the main reasons why we are Hall of Famers today, in my opinion.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Now, do you ever go back and watch highlights of that team and think, man, we could really pass it?
I don't have to. It's etched in my brain. I don't need to watch any films. I experienced it firsthand. I only own my own regrets when I think back on my career, especially when I was with the Celtics. I wish I had taken more time to enjoy the journey. I really didn't understand how special it was and how rewarding and gratifying the experience was until after I retired.
So at what
moment did it hit you, kind of?
Maybe a year later, I would fit back on my career about a year after I had retired. I just sitting down one day idly thinking about a lot of different things, and then my career appeared on my noggin, and then I started thinking about I had one hell of a career. And then how many players can say that they played with, let's see, I think I played with like 7 or 8 Hall of Famers. Think about that for a second. How many players could say that? How many athletes could say that?
Now, you have definitely had a very storied career. There's no doubt about that. Your teams are the teams that really I grew up on. And how much did you guys really hate the Pistons? Like, legitimately in your hearts? Like, or how much of it was just professional rivalry?
I think hate is too strong of a word. But it was a very healthy dislike, not only for the Pistons, but the 76ers, the Lakers. I think Dallas was a pretty good team. The Dallas Mavericks, we didn't like them either. San Antonio, we didn't like them either. Every team that we considered competition for the championship, we had a healthy dislike for them.
So when a guy like LeBron James comes out and says, yeah, I'd love to play with this guy and that guy and that guy and that guy for a few years, and they're all on different teams, how does that strike you? How do you think the attitudes have changed, and why have they changed so much over the years?
Well, I think the correct terminology would be the millenniums. Things have changed. It's a new era. I think the players of the day, not only the players, but young people today are more accepting, are more liberated in their thinking. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's easier for the players today to embrace the philosophy of joining forces or ranks with their contemporaries to enhance their careers. Personally, I don't see nothing wrong with it. Because I guess in a roundabout way, you can say I did it, even though it wasn't under my control or my power. I was traded, but I joined forces with two hell of a players too. So technically, you can say that about me. Even though I was traded, I didn't go on my own free will, but I did the same thing when you think about my career.
I get the feeling you probably would have gone on your own free will anyway, based on your thoughts about the Warriors.
Oh, I would have left the Warriors. Oh, but when you're in a good situation, take for granted all the rhetoric and the narrative out there about Kevin Durant joining the Warriors to try to win a championship. Not that he will. That's just the narrative out there, you know, the spin out there right now. Now think about that for a second.
Yeah, they'd be a pretty talented team.
Oh, and all of them are young too. My only question about that is Durant's defense. I don't think his defense is on the same level with his offensive prowesses. He needs to pick it up on the defensive end. With his skill set, he should be a much better defensive player. Consistently. Yeah. He's not consistent with his efforts on the defensive end.
You make a valid point there.
That would be my only concern about him joining the Warriors, because I think they would take a step back defensively. And not to mention what they had to give up to add Durant to the roster.
Yeah, and then there's the whole chemistry thing would be tough.
You have to think about all that too, the chemistry, the camaraderie. That it just kind of throws things out of balance for a minute. I think if anybody could make a smooth transition to that team, because Durant has the mentality of he don't have to be the man on the team, obviously, because he lets Westbrook be the man for the most part. So I think he can make a smooth transition in that regard.
Yeah, now we're talking about Kevin Durant, one of the greatest players in the NBA today. You play with two of the greatest players ever, including Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, and among many, many other Hall of Famers. But those two guys specifically, how are those similar and different as competitors?
The similarities between Larry, Kevin, and Michael, that their unquenchable desire to win and be successful. They had a thirst that just couldn't be quenched. And their drive and their ambition. And one thing I like about those three players that I play with, and you could throw Scottie Pippen in there also, is that during their premium years, they got better every year. I always respected that. They never gloated, got by on their past achievements. Every summer, they got better. Every year they came back, they were a better player. And that's one of the reasons why I hold them in such high regard as athletes, because that's something that I try to do in my own personal career. I try to be a little bit better during my premium years every time I came back for the upcoming season.
How does a player do that? Like when you go into an off season thinking, do you think I need to add one more element to my game? Do you try to refine something in your game you think that might need a little enhancement? What's the mentality in going into the summer, especially for you, because you were constantly in the playoffs, winning championships? You're playing very long seasons, so you needed to rest as well. How does a player go from great to even better over the off season?
Well, for me personally, I take 3 weeks off. I don't do anything, let my body calm down, heal up a little bit. Then I'm right back on the grind. What makes great players great, in my opinion, they have great work ethics, a thirst to be better. You work on your weaknesses. You're always working on your weaknesses, whatever your weaknesses may be. You don't have a good left hand. You're not good going to your left. Your dribbling needs to improve. Your passing needs to improve. Your free throw shooting. Your shooting. And also, while you're working on your weaknesses, you're also working on your strengths also. And then also, you're working on your defense, because everybody can improve defensively. Always. Because that's mental. It has very little to do with talent. Defense is psychological, mental. You got to want to be a good defensive player consistently. And so those are the things that you got to do to make yourself great and keep yourself great. You got to have a love affair with getting better. Matter of fact, you should be in love with the process, because you're not always going to be rewarded with success, especially when things are not going well, because from my perspective, sports mirrors life. It ebbs and it flows. When your game is ebbing, that's when you got to learn the process of getting better and correcting what's wrong with your game, why you're not playing well.
Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram.
Yep. Now you've talked about these guys, Kevin McHale and Larry Bird. One thing, a few years ago, there was an article, I think it was in the Boston Globe, and one thing that stood out to me about it was that you don't seem to be too tight with those guys these days. What was your relationship like with those guys when you did play together?
We would never tight. We I wouldn't say we are friends. We never went out and to dinner, movies. Besides, they were married, and except for 2 years in my stay in Boston when I was married, I was a single man. We don't have nothing in common except for basketball. I wouldn't call them friends. the two players on the team that I would call friends would be Dennis Johnson and Bill Walton. They were my friends. Because we did things together. We hung out. We interacted with one another. Kevin, Larry, and myself, we didn't interact off the court. So I never considered us to be friends. We are friendly and respectful towards one another, obviously. Or we wouldn't have the camaraderie and the chemistry on the court. But I wouldn't call them friends. And nah, it's nothing personal. Now, I don't want you to read into this that I got a axe to grind with them, because I don't. I respect them. We just not friends.
Now, how do you build such great chemistry with those guys if you're not close? It seems like a lot of people think you have to be friends in the locker room to have that chemistry.
You don't have to be, going out to dinner and movies, off the court. On the court, we share a common goal. We all of us want to achieve excellence. We all willing to make sacrifices for that goal. And not to mention, there's a very healthy respect between us. We all respect one another. I don't think that ever changed. We ain't got to be hugging and kissing. At least from my perspective, anyways.
Yeah. Now you said one person who helped build that camaraderie was Red Auerbach from the top. Everyone I talk to seems to have a favorite Red Auerbach story. Do you have one?
I have a favorite story, something that Red told me, because when, as you probably remember, when I got traded from the Golden State Warriors to the Boston Celtics, there were some questions about me as a player and about my game, because I really hadn't established myself just yet. And so when Dave Cowens decided to retire during the exhibition season, my first year in Boston, Red came to me and pulled me aside and told me that do not listen to the media and the critics, because they can be very harsh. And he told me, you know what you can and cannot do, and just go out and be Robert Parrish. Do not listen to the noise, because that's their job, to question, to second guess, and to critique you as a player. You just do you. And that's the most profound advice that Red ever gave me. And I respect him for that, because he didn't have to say a word to me. It's my job to go out and try to fill that void that Dave Cowens left.
Now, how much did you need that particular advice to kind of come in and be yourself?
I didn't need it personally, because I'm self-motivated. I don't need any outside motivation. My motivation comes within, because obviously I was good enough to be in the NBA. So it's up to me to improve and be better so I can stay in the league. Because it's one thing to get drafted into the NBA, but you got to do whatever it takes to stay there, be a profession. Because I feel like if you're not trying to get better as a person, as an athlete, you're doing yourself, your teammates, the game, the organization, a huge disservice.
The NBA season is a very long grind. It's 82 games plus the playoffs. You're working with these guys every day, traveling. And not only that, back when you were playing, you guys were traveling coach, right?
No, we was in first class.
We but you're commercial. You're flying commercial.
We had a private plane. Is that what you had?
That's what I mean. I meant you. Yeah, but you were flying commercial. You had to schedule flights.
Right.
So, first of all, on a back-to-back, can you explain a little bit because nowadays on a back-to-back, guys can get on their private plane. It's waiting for them. You get to the next city, and it's still a grind, but it's not what you guys had to do. So can you explain a little bit of what the process of playing a back-to-back game was back in the 80s?
Oh, it was definitely a grind back then, because a back-to-back, that means you had like a 7 o'clock flight or a 6:30 flight. So that means you got a wake-up call at like 4 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning to get to the airport. Plus you got take into consideration all the luggage that you got to get checked. And so, and then you're not getting enough rest because after the game you wound up, you don't get to sleep. At least for me, I didn't get to sleep till like 1, 2 in the morning because I'm so wound up at the game from all that physical exertion. And so by the time you doze off, it's time to get up. Then you're not getting your proper rest. And now your body clock is all thrown off. And that sometimes it hampers your performance the following night because you don't get enough rest. Because you're sleeping all day, which I don't think is good because then you, at least for me, it makes me lethargic when I'm trying to make up for lost sleep. And then you're trying to wake your body up and get ready for the game the following night. So it definitely was challenging. So it just put more emphasis on keeping myself in the best physical condition that I possibly could be in and to maintain it, because I think that helps with the physical challenges of the over an NBA season.
So you would get a 4 o'clock wake up call. You'd go to the hotel. Would you have to wait in line to personally check your bags?
No, we didn't have to check out bag. We had an equipment manager.
Okay, thank God.
That did all that, but you still got to get up. You got to pack, you know, and you got to get to the airport. You're pretty much sleepwalking, at least for me sometimes, because it always took me a while to unwind after a game.
That's still amazing. And then you'd have to go out and bang with Lambeer the next night.
Oh, definitely. That's where the professionalism comes in. You got to be a professional. Every night, I always had the mindset, somebody's watching me play for the first time. So I took it as a personal challenge to be the best I could be every night out for that person that's seeing me play for the first time. I thought it was important for me to be my very best every night out.
So this is a long grind. It's tough. You're playing against... I think back then, the competition, so many great players and so many great teams. You spent a lot of time doing very serious work on the court, but the locker room, there had to be some fun moments because you got to break the stress and everything. So what's the funniest thing that you remember from your days in the NBA in the locker room?
Well, it wasn't so much... In the locker room, we had this radio commentator, Johnny Most, and he was a chain smoker. He smoked cigarette after cigarette after cigarette. So one of my teammates, Danny Ainge, got these, I don't know what you would call them, these candy cigarettes that explode after you light them, had the explosive tip. And so Danny replaced 3 or 4 of Johnny Moe's cigarettes with these explosive cigarettes. And so Johnny Moe always slept on the plant. Every flight, he went to sleep. And so when he woke up, first thing he did was he lit up a cigarette. And so he would light up a cigarette, and then it would explode. He'd be like, "What the MF?" And then he'd take out another cigarette, and it would explode. He's like, "What MF bothered my cigarettes?" And then he'd take out another one, and it would explode. And then he's getting up, ranting up and down the hall. I mean, up down the walkway. And of course, the steward just got to intervene after that, because you're not supposed to be walking up down the aisle, you know, and throwing a temper tantrum. And so we all about falling out of our seats with laughter. Everybody thought it was funny, but Johnny Most.
That is an amazing story. I have to say, that's a perfect place for us to end this conversation. We don't want to take up too much of your time. I do want to say that people do have an opportunity to come out and meet you in Saugus, Friday, April 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the I Love Boston Sports Store at the Square One Mall in Saugus. So, if you want to come out and meet Robert Parrish, who has just had given us an amazing conversation, Friday, April 15th from 7 to 9 at the Square One Mall in Saugus. Robert Parrish, thank you very, very much for your time. It was a great conversation.
Thank both of you for the memories, and I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. Thank you much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun talking to Chief. I mean, he's great. And now, coming up, is a conversation tomorrow in two parts with Tommy Heinsohn. And I'll tell you, Tommy Heinsohn wasn't quite as complimentary about Robert Parrish, which was part of the conversation that he doesn't think that Robert Parrish was one of the 50 greatest players of all time. So that's an interesting conversation to kind of follow up this one with. So tomorrow and Friday, a very long conversation in two parts with Tommy Heinsohn. So subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. If you have, please give that 5-star rating, that good written review. It's a great help as we continue to try and grow this podcast. Before we go, I want to share with you one of the best programs that we've got here on the Locked On Podcast Network. It's called Rejecting the Screen. They've got amazing interviews with NBA people uncovering never told stories or unknown tales of the NBA. You can subscribe to Rejecting the Screen on iTunes or follow on Spotify. Here now is a collection of the best of Rejecting the Screen with Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko.
Hey, it's Noah Kozlov from Rejecting the Screen on the Locked On Podcast Network. Adam Stanko and I get together twice a week to talk hoops with folks who have touched the NBA on all sorts of levels, from all-stars, coaches, executives, and media members. Recently, the number 3 pick in the 2006 NBA draft, Adam Morrison, joined us to tell a story about how Kobe Bryant, his former Lakers teammate with whom he won 2 rings, went above and beyond to lift his spirits.
It was a year after I was out, and so I wasn't playing, obviously, and I was really depressed, and I was basically a hermit in my own house, and I didn't go out in the community at all. And you know, if you did, it was one of people asking you, why aren't you playing? And I was, you know, I'm 26 at the time or whatever I was, and, you know, number 3 pick, and just really low point in my life. And I get a text from Robert Lara, the Lakers security, and it was Kobe's, like, one of his best friends. And he said, hey, what's your address? I got something in the mail for you. And I get the package, and it's an autographed jersey from Didier Drogba, who is my favorite player. I'm a Chelsea fan. You know, it was from Kobe. And game-worn jersey, you know, signed Didier Drogba, to Adam, best wishes. And I always thought Kobe, you know, made a phone call, which is, would be fine. It's still cool as shit. It's unbelievable. The night he passed, I'm scrolling through, reading everything, and I'm emotional. And on Chelsea's, you know, Instagram page, it's him with Didier Drogba holding up a jersey, and it says, to Adam, best wishes. So he went up to my favorite player, got it signed for him without me even asking, and sent it to me when he knew I was low. That's what Kobe Bryant was, man. He was just one of those dudes who understood his own aura.
When 4-time All-Star Sean Marion hung out with us, not only did he tell us that he tried to recruit Kobe Bryant to the Suns the summer that the Suns ended up signing Steve Nash and Quentin Richardson, he also told us that his 2006 Suns team should have won the title. In the 2011 preseason, his Mavericks teammate Jason Terry was so confident they'd win it all, he got a tattoo of the trophy.
We was at Deshaun Stevenson house. We had a game in Orlando, and we went to his house, and you know, a few of the team, and we was over having bar eating and stuff. And then this tattoo guy came over there, and Jet guy tattooed a trophy on his bicep. I was like, damn, dude. I was like, for real? I was like, okay. I'm loving it. I'm loving the confidence and the swag we have right now. So, like, let alone, don't nobody else in the world know we doing this and we feeling this right now. Because everybody in the league has aspirations. A lot of teams have aspirations to win championships, but it ain't but maybe a handful that actually can do it. You know what I'm saying? So we was one of those teams, and, like, we sitting there going through this process and looking at this, and, yeah, we was like, yeah.
Did he tell you, hey, I'm going to get a tattoo of the trophy? Did you know as it was happening, or once he got it, he showed you, he's got a tattoo of the trophy?
Well, it was all kind of one sequence. He's like, we won the championship this year. I'm about to get a trophy right now. Okay. We were like, okay, that's what's up.
I mean,
you don't get no better than that. Come on now. You don't get no better than that.
Does it?
You don't get no better than that.
Kevin Willis never did win a ring, but he was an All-Star and was one of the most dominant rebounders of his era. He spent year 16 of his career with the Toronto Raptors when Tracy McGrady was in year 2 and Vince Carter was a rookie. As expected, he had some pretty good advice for those kids.
They used to call me OG, old head, things like that. And I think I was in my 15th year or somewhere up in there. And it was like, yeah, man. I used to tell him and T-Mac. I say, T-Mac, first of all, you need to stop falling asleep on the bench and practice. You got to stay awake. You keep falling asleep. I used to tell him and Vince, you guys rather hope that you get the 15 years because you little snot-nosed rookies. But, you know, they were great, great rookies. Great talent.
Speaking of vets and rookies, when Suns legend Eddie Johnson got traded to Seattle, Gary Payton was a rookie point guard. And since everyone loves a good one about GP running his mouth, Eddie delivered.
And I remember one day at practice, I was there for about 2 weeks. And I remember he kept disrupting practice. And Gary's a smart guy. He had a right to talk in that regard because as I got to know him, he really knows the game, obviously. Hall of Famer. He's one of the greatest defenders ever now. But at the time, he was a rookie. And rookies were not supposed to talk under my watch.
Right.
So that's what it was for me. And I just couldn't get over the fact that this rookie kept talking. You know, and I let it go for 2 weeks. And I asked Nate McMillan, I said, is it a point in time, man, when you all like gonna say something to him? And Nate was like, man, you know. You know, Nate kind of shook it off. And I said, well, I'm going to say something. And lo and behold, one practice, he's got the yapping and, you know, coaches going over stuff and he yapping. And I just finally said, would you shut the F up?
About 15 years later in Seattle, PJ Carlesimo was coaching the Sonics with rookie Kevin Durant. When PJ came on the show, he revealed how ahead of the curve his staff was when KD was on the floor.
One good thing we really did with him was we exposed him to a lot of things in terms of we played him at 2, we played him at 3, we played him at 4, we put him in pick and rolls, we encouraged him to shoot threes. It's his only bad 3-point percentage. If you look at his percentage year by year in the NBA, it's far and away the lowest one. But again, in those days, it was even a bigger jump from college 3 to NBA 3. And Kevin didn't shoot a lot of threes at Texas. And we had him do that. And at times we were criticized, like, why are they playing this guy at guard? Why are they putting him in pick and rolls? You know, why are they letting him dribble the ball up the court? Because he could.
Staying with coaches, Brendan Haywood won a title with the Mavs in 2011. And when he joined LeBron in the Cavs under David Blatt, it was obvious when a head coaching change was needed.
We could see late in ball games, if he had to draw plays, we could see he was super nervous. His hands would be shaking. He'd have to give the clipboard to Larry Drew. Larry Drew would draw the plays up. And when you see that, you understand. Like, this dude ain't ready. He's not ready for this. He's not ready for this. And it's not his fault because he thought he was taking on a rebuilding project. And then next thing you know, LeBron James calls up David Blatt and says, I'm coming. And now, instead of taking on a rebuilding project with Kyrie and Deion Waiters at the forefront of it, and Tristan Thompson, you have LeBron James and Kevin Love there, and now you're competing for a title. I think Coach Blatt got hit with too much too soon, but it was easy to tell right away that Coach Blatt was probably in over his head.
Just like a head coach can lose a team, a woman can tear one apart as well. Butch Beard was an assistant with the Mavericks in the mid-90s as Grammy Award-winning R&B singer Toni Braxton came in between stars Jason Kidd and Jimmy Jackson.
I mean, it ended up being Jason and Jimmy, all right? Jason, Tony. Tony's not caring about either one of them. And then the team was taking sides. So I'll never forget, we had a damn team meeting. And I said, guys, it's a woman that's breaking us apart. And if the woman is that good, please, I want to see what her mother looks like because I want to date her mother. Come on.
Entertainment and the NBA will always be intertwined. The first to do that on the media side was the New York Post's Peter Vesey, who was also the sideline reporter for the national broadcasts on NBC. We asked Peter about his post-game interview with Karl Malone after the Jazz lost in the finals to the Bulls in 1997. The YouTube clip is titled, Peter Vesey tries to get punched.
Carl was always a great interview. He would never not answer a question. You know, we really didn't get along. I disliked him on many levels, respected him on many other levels as a player, but, you know, he was a dirty player. And the first time that they showed it to me, I didn't even remember it. Okay. So I did this interview. I had no agenda. I was just going to ask him some tough questions, and I didn't care how tough because I really didn't like him. So, but I knew he was going to answer them. So I didn't feel unsafe, and I didn't feel like I was doing something wrong. And it never dawned on me that that came off the way it did. You know, my son would say to me, he said, "Wow, like, what were you thinking?" I said, "I was just doing my job." But I had no mindset going in other than I knew he was going to answer my question.
In 1997, former head coach Hubie Brown was broadcasting for TNT, but 5 years later was hired by Jerry West mid-season to coach the Memphis Grizzlies. Point guard Earl Watson was in his second year with the team and was thoroughly confused when it all went down.
Jerry West introduced Hubie. I'm 22 years old. We're in Memphis, losing franchise. First time in my life I ever been a part of anything that was losing. So it's all new to me. Just everything was like new to me. It almost made me sick. He introduces Hubie Brown, and I'm thinking, I got to call Bob because we just hired the TNT guy. This is crazy. I didn't know his full resume, right? So the first thing he says to us, he takes the podium and he says, "First, I would like to say, you all are fucking losers. None of you are winners. If you was a winner, the other guy wouldn't be packing his stuff with his family, see? You got on fire. You're fucking losers. I'm going to teach you how to be a winner. I'm going to teach you how to be a winner."
The Bob that Earl referred to was Bob Myers, his agent at the time and now the president of the Golden State Warriors. Stories like these are a taste of what rejecting the screen sounds like every week. So we hope you'll join us by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, follow on Spotify, or download and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Once again, you can follow Rejecting the Screen on Spotify or subscribe on iTunes.